broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network. This is Cultural Baggage. My name is Dean Becker. I report the unvarnished truth about the prison industrial complex that threatens the future of our nation. And so the question is, my friends, just what time is it? The scope of the scandal in the state of injustice where grand jury system broken. Australia may be king of the kangaroo, but the city of Houston stands alone as king of the kangaroo courts, of corrupt, pseudo-ignorant public officials and go-along-to-get-along cops, doctors, judges, and media. But over the last few years, I've been amazed at the determination and courage of the Houston Chronicle. Scope of the scandal is an op-ed that appeared in last Sunday's paper. It was written by two men involved in the Texas Innocence Project, attorneys Barry Scheck and David Dow, who we'll hear from later in the program. State of Injustice, Sunday's editorial from the Chronicle editorial board, which proclaimed, "Crime lab investigation reveals indifference to right and wrong throughout the criminal justice system." Grand jury system broken. A letter to the editor, published in Tuesday's Chronicle, was written by T.W. Weston, the chairman of the Harris County Grand Jury Association. Here to talk about the grand jury system is the former head of the Harris County Criminal Lawyers Association.
I'm Edward Millett. I am a lifelong Houstonian, and I have been an attorney in Houston for almost 30 years.
Yeah, your thoughts, sir. Do we have it wrong here in the state of Texas?
We have a lot right and a lot wrong in the state of Texas, but I guess what you're interested in is the grand jury.
Well, the grand jury, the machinations of the drug war itself, sir.
Well, we'll talk small first. Many, many years ago in England, before the discovery of America, there was a system of justice whereby the representative of the king, which was the sheriff, would appoint 12 people. And once a year, a judge would come through, and those 12 would report of any crimes or misconduct. And if they reported no crimes or misconduct, they were punished. Naturally, someone was always accused of a crime. It was a perfect system of justice. And that led to today's grand jury, a group that is picked in secret and that meets in secret. It's picked in secret in that each judge who impanels a grand jury appoints five friends of the judge, or five people known to the judge. Those people, in turn, designate their friends or their acquaintances to be on the grand jury. The grand jury then goes and meets in a secret room. If the district attorney wants to charge somebody with a felony, having the approval of the grand jury is a necessary step in bringing the case to trial. The grand jury has to vote a true bill of indictment. However, only the district attorney can go in the grand jury room. The defense lawyer can't go in there, and a person who's suspected has no right to go in there. Hence, the grand juries often indict people who don't even know they're under investigation, and sometimes they indict people who are dead because the investigation started and it went its course and they filed these charges and they didn't know that someone had passed away, illness, old age, or accident. So to think of the grand jury as a part of the adversary system is to completely misunderstand that the grand jury works in the courts as a tool of the prosecution, as a place to have secret trials in which people don't even know that they're under investigation. I don't think that works for justice or fairness or even is consistent with what most people think is the way this country is governed.
Insofar as the process of the drug war, it has drawn from fear and disseminates fear to maintain itself. Do you concur with that?
Well, I think of the drug war as being only a little bit more valid than racial segregation. For years in the South, from Reconstruction until into the 50s, and in some contexts even today, we had institutions founded on the principle of racial segregation. Some people believe that it was biblically required that there were two sorts of human beings, and indeed when the Constitution was written, a person of African-American descent was only three-fifths of a whole person. And we had these institutions of segregation with principals for black schools who were black and principals for white schools who were white, and restaurants only for black people and restaurants only for white people. It is all this institutional money, infrastructure built on the preservation of segregation. Trade unions, the Longshoremen's Union, black locals and white locals. We had institutions which supported the continuation of injustice. And today, I believe the war on drugs is an enormous economic complex. I remember President Eisenhower saying we needed to worry about the military-industrial complex. Well, I think we should worry today about the anti-drug industrial complex having too much political power in this country. Too many people have their jobs based on the continuation of the so-called war on drugs. You can't even talk about legalizing marijuana without getting thrown out of school. And so it's a terrible thing.
Yes, sir. And those you speak of that are in support of that prison industrial complex are the very ones given the bully pulpit, are the ones whose word we are supposed to respect in this regard. Is that true?
Yeah, I think in many cases they really know not what they do.
We
didn't let women vote in this country. We didn't let women serve on juries. We went through a time in this country when a man couldn't buy a cold beer because society thought it would impose a higher morality on all of us. And, of course, all of those things have now failed. And this war on drugs, this too will fail. The only issue is when and how many lives will be destroyed before a higher degree of rationality and fairness and sophistication takes over. There are quite a few so-called conservatives today who will agree that the government really has no place in the bedroom of consenting adults, telling them what pleasures they can enjoy.
Thanks to a local medical marijuana organization's donation of $200, we now offer a cash reward of $1,200 to any drug warrior who will visit our radio show and accept the DOT Award. Even here in the heart of Mordor, in the central city of eternal drug war, Houston, Texas, there is no one willing to step forward to claim this $1,200. So each week we create a news report on their behalf. Cowards.
In Houston, Texas, the grossly underfunded HPD crime lab is undergoing an investigation. They're uncovering all sorts of nasty skeletons. Let's just say it's likely that mistakes have been made and innocent people may have been affected. You see, in Houston, the drug problem has become so rampant that the identification of illegal narcotics accounts for 75% of the crime lab's work. Wild-eyed drug legalization advocates everywhere have latched onto this story and declared it to be concrete evidence that we must end the drug war. This is absurd. The idea that we should cease to enforce laws because the task of enforcing the law is overbearing is insane. What if it was hard to catch a rapist? Do we legalize it? No, of course not. The problem with the HPD crime lab is funding. The drug epidemic is out of control and is now hampering law enforcement's ability to do their work effectively. HPD is in need of more resources to help battle the drug epidemic. More funding and more resources to fix the problem, not run away from it. This has been Winston Francis with the official Government Truth.
According to Dr. Ivzin Ruzica, an attending neurologist at Charles University in the Czech Republic, quote, "Nearly half of Parkinson's disease patients who have tried marijuana say the drug helped relieve their symptoms," end quote.
It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects.
Nausea, sleeplessness, constipation, involuntary movement, dizziness upon standing, hallucinations, and according to the Associated Press, gambling addiction. Time's up. The answer, according to the Associated Press, Mirapex, approved by the FDA for Parkinson's disease. As long as white people feel more comfortable watching cops wrestle people of color to the ground for little baggies, pipes, and syringes, as long as people of color allow the networks to display constant videos of down-and-out drug users as the modern equivalent of step and fetch it, the drug war will abide.
What happens when a system can't be trusted? Crime labs get overworked and backed up. If tests don't get done in time, an offender may go free, however, so sometimes results get faked. This practice is known as dry labbing. In Houston, Texas, a recent scandal over that practice means evidence and convictions in thousands of drug cases over the past 7 years may be called into question. Prosecutors knew about this for years, but kept their mouths shut. Grand juries looked into the crime lab scandals, yet they found no problems. On the other hand, a University of Houston study of the grand jury system in that county found that just over 50% of the grand jury commissioners selected in 2002 and 2003 were linked to the area's legal establishment, including judges, attorneys, and even police officers. One judge appointed three of his own court employees as commissioners. There's no proof any of these grand juries did anything improper, yet that kind of stacked deck gives the appearance of unfairness and gives the disempowered the impression they can't win, so they have nothing to lose. We talk about a drug war, yet is the price of victory worth any cost? For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org.
Now here to speak on the Houston Crime Lab and the system of criminal justice is David Dow.
I am on the faculty at the University of Houston Law Center, and I am also the founder and the director of the Texas Innocence Network, which is an organization that investigates claims that certain people in prison are actually innocent of the crime that they were convicted of.
Yes, sir, and this past Sunday, you and a fellow attorney, Barry Scheck, published an op-ed in the Houston Chronicle. Please tell us about that.
That's right. Barry Scheck is obviously a well-known criminal defense lawyer. He is the co-founder of the Innocence Project based in New York. It's an organization similar to ours, except that it is limited to cases that involve DNA, whereas the Texas organization is not limited to DNA cases. But Barry is a lawyer, but also an expert on forensics, and he's been interested in the scandals at the Houston Crime Lab really since the story first broke several years ago now. And aside from being interested in the story, he's also had the view that the problems in the DNA serology unit were just going to be the tip of the iceberg, and that there would also be problems we would learn in other sections of the lab involving hair and fiber analysis, toxicology, and also ballistics. And I think that Barry's prediction has been borne out by time, and that all of those other units of the lab have also been shown to have had some problems.
The inclusion, if you will, of the 75% approximate cases that deal with the drug war, with chemical analysis and so forth, and then the vast failure of the personnel in the crime lab, there could be thousands of people incorrectly sitting behind prison bars.
I think that thousands is probably a reasonable guess. We don't really know exactly how severe the problem is, but unfortunately what we do know is that the problem has two different dimensions. One dimension is that there were mistakes made simply because of negligence and improper attention. There wasn't enough funding, there wasn't adequate supervision, and all of those sorts of mistakes, as tragic as they are at least not intentional mistakes. But that's only one dimension. The other dimension that we've discovered is that there has been dry labbing that's gone on, that there's been actual scientific fraud, that there's been, you know, to not pull any punches here, lying. And so that when you combine innocent mistakes with intentional mistakes, the likelihood is that there are going to be thousands of people who are affected by that.
Well, sir, and as you say, it goes on and on. There's even the fact that once these people were found dry labbing, they were not fired. They were not brought to trial. There was not that much done.
Yeah, I would have to say that, in my opinion, one of, if not the most disturbing aspect in the report that was just released, the third report, actually, that was just released by the independent commission that's investigating the lab failures, is the description of what happened to the two scientists who were, in fact, engaging in dry labbing. Dry labbing, of course, being the term for scientific fraud. And what happened to them was basically nothing. One of them got a very mild punishment, even though his supervisor thought he ought to be fired. The other didn't get any punishment at all. Now, the report that was issued a couple of weeks ago doesn't address why nothing happened. It simply observes that nothing happened. I think that the question of why nothing happened is an appropriate line of inquiry for the Houston City Council. The City Council ought to know and ought to get to the bottom of the question of why people who are employed by the City of Houston can engage in what amounts to fraudulent criminal conduct and suffer no repercussions as a result of that. I would think the City Council ought to be champing at the bit to investigate this question. I'm also very curious to know why the District Attorney's Office didn't do anything about it. Now, there are all sorts of possible explanations. Maybe there was a statute of limitations problem. Maybe the District Attorney's Office thought somebody else was going to take care of it. Maybe the District Attorney's Office thought that the civil service protections would be too onerous to surmount. But somebody needs to say why nothing happened to these two analysts who were engaged in scientific fraud, and I haven't heard anybody offer an explanation of that to this day.
Well, over the last few years, we've discovered that the crime lab was a sieve. During a rainstorm, water would leak in, rats had access to the evidence, and we also learned that even the supervisors did not know how to calibrate their devices with which they made their determinations. It's so widespread, it's hard to wrap your arms around.
Yes, and that goes back to the point that I was making just a moment ago, that I think that there are two different dimensions. What you've just focused on is the dimension that I characterize as inadequate attention. And by inadequate attention, I mean not enough money, not enough focus on having competent supervisors, not enough personnel, not enough training. I mean, all of those mistakes are obviously terrible, egregious mistakes, particularly when they lead to the incarceration of somebody who didn't do anything wrong, and yet they don't rise to the level of criminal conduct or fraud. They certainly need to be addressed, and I must say that I would have taken some degree of comfort if it had turned out that all of the mistakes were limited to that dimension, because then we'd be able to say, well, you know what, all we really need to do to solve this problem is spend the amount of money that we ought to be spending on the crime lab. But as it happens, that is not the dimension that the problem is limited to. We have this additional dimension, which is the more serious one, I think, which is that you basically have people in that lab who are engaged in fraudulent activity. We don't know how many there are. We don't know how many cases. We don't know the extent of the fraud. We don't know whether anybody actually went to prison because of fraud. But we do know that in at least four cases there was fraud, and we also know that in all four of those cases nobody got a serious punishment. And so it seems to me that it is reasonable to infer that there are some number of people who were in prison as a result of fraudulent conduct.
Well, David Dow, let me ask you. I noticed in the Chronicle's editorial on Sunday they indicated something to the effect that the people of Harris County need to recognize this problem and they need to do something about it, or the innocent will continue to go to prison and the guilty go free. What can we do, sir?
I think that the Chronicle editorial did a very good job of pointing out a fact that is often overlooked. And that fact is that when somebody who is not guilty goes to prison for having committed a crime, what it means is that the person who did commit the crime is not in prison. And when these are drug cases, that's one thing, but when these are rape cases or murder cases, it's something else entirely. When an innocent person goes to prison in a rape case, It means that there is a rapist who is not in prison, who is still on the streets, able to commit more rapes. When somebody is convicted of a murder that he didn't commit, and that person goes to prison, it means that the actual murderer is not in prison, is still on the streets, and able to commit additional murders. And I think that one very useful observation in the Houston Chronicle, and I thought it was just top to bottom a strong editorial, but I thought that one particularly useful observation that is not mentioned often enough is that when an innocent person goes to prison, it means that the guilty person is not in prison. And I think that the district attorneys across the state, I think that the Harris County District Attorney's Office in particular, needs to acknowledge that fact, and it needs to come to grips with the fact that when it makes mistakes, when it sends innocent people to prison, it's not only not doing its job, it's also creating a danger for the rest of us because it's leaving dangerous people out on the street.
No, I concur with you. I think Mr. Rosenthal here in Harris County is playing rope-a-dope. I think some of these indictments you spoke of could have taken place were he to have brought focus to bear on what had happened with the dry labbing. And I think it's similar to what many of the politicians, judges, etc. do, and that is to just wait it out, to not step up to the plate and bear any responsibility in trying to correct this problem.
One problem, you know, I don't disagree with that. I don't have an alternative explanation, but one problem that we have, and one difficulty in even trying to figure out what the explanation is that people who ought to be talking and explaining themselves aren't. I haven't heard the district attorney, I haven't heard Mr. Rosenthal address this problem. I haven't heard him offer an explanation of why the district attorney's office didn't take any action in these cases. I haven't even heard him address the problem of leaving perpetrators out on the street when they send innocent people to prison. You know, my client, Josiah Sutton, was sent to prison by the Harris County District Attorney's Office. To this day, the district attorney has refused to acknowledge that my client is innocent, even though DNA proves that he is. Aside from the fact that the district attorney sent Josiah Sutton, an innocent man, to prison for nearly 5 years, what it also means is that the district attorney's office did not send the guilty party to prison for any time at all. The same thing is true in the George Rodriguez case. George Rodriguez was convicted of a rape, prosecuted by Harris County. DNA analysis proves that Mr. Rodriguez did not commit that crime. Not only has Mr. Rosenthal refused to acknowledge that Mr. Rodriguez is innocent, Mr. Rosenthal has also not taken responsibility for the fact that an actual rapist remained on the street because the district attorney's office sent the wrong person to prison. I mean, I think that the observation that I would be willing to make as a general matter about the district attorney's office is that it doesn't take responsibility for its mistakes. It doesn't take responsibility for the costs to society of its mistakes. And it seems to be very good at hiding like a turtle in its shell when there are serious problems that it needs to address, like these problems in the crime lab, like these problems of not prosecuting people who engaged in scientific fraud.
Well, the only drug warrior I ever had the chance to interview was Mr. Rosenthal. He told me something like, when the only tool you have to work with is a hammer, everything begins to look like a nail.
Well, I mean that sounds like an observation that I would expect from Mr. Rosenthal, and what I mean by that is I don't understand it. I don't understand how it's an answer to this problem. The one thing that's true about the district attorney's office is that they have more tools than, you know, Ace Hardware has. They have any tool that they want. They've got lots of money. They can make any prosecutorial decision that they want to. They can call on vast scientific, forensic, and law enforcement resources in order to get the job done. And if they're not getting the job done, it's not because all that they have is a hammer. They have hammers and screwdrivers and drills and wrenches and power saws. They have every tool that they need. If they're not getting the job done, it's not because they don't have the tools. It's because they don't know how to use them or because they're not using them.
I want to thank you for joining us today. I think you're doing wonderful work, sir.
Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure being with you.
This is Nora Callahan with the November Coalition joining the Drug Truth Network. Well, the March on Washington plans are proceeding for August 13th, 2005, Lafayette Park from 9 o'clock to 2 p.m. in Washington, D.C. It's just north side of the White House, new developments. There are organizers in cities around the country that are planning for sister gatherings. Seattle is one, and the website at www.journeyforjustice.org will reflect sister rallies. We want to urge people who aren't able to travel to D.C. to have demonstrations and gatherings on August 13th where they live. And you can tune in to November.org for details about how to plan an event.
So, summer's here, and perhaps the time is not quite right for fighting in the streets of Houston. With the humidity, some say it's hotter than Baghdad. Likely, Houston's skirmishes will wait for the cool winds of late October and for full implementation of Houston's For the Children campaign to end drug prohibition. Just who objects to the drug war? Nobel laureate Milton Friedman certainly objects strenuously to the hundreds of billions of dollars wasted on drug prohibition, but as a guest on this show, he was compelled to state, quote, "My main objection to the drug war is on moral grounds. I think it's a disgrace and a scandal," end quote. The scandal and the injustice of the drug war are obvious at every turn in Harris County, from the enormous stockpiles of prohibited drugs at the crime lab to the overload at the jails, courtrooms, and treatment centers with small-time drug users and sellers. The people of Houston and Harris County are the world's leading jailers. The U.S. represents 5% of the Earth's population, and the U.S. locks up 25% of the world's prisoners. Texas leads the U.S., certainly per capita, and Harris County leads Texas by far in the rate of incarcerating its own citizens. Illegal drugs are made by untrained chemists, invariably mixed with various agents to dilute for profits, and oft-times delivered by armed gang members. Yet tobacco and alcohol kill well over 100 times more people each year than do all these illegal drugs combined. Justice, logic, scientific fact, and medical data fail abysmally to support the policy of drug prohibition. When we provide state control and regulation, we will eliminate the reasons for which most violent street gangs exist. By allowing for federal oversight of drug shipments, we would destroy the money tree of the armed forces, cartels, and rebels in Colombia and Mexico. Most importantly, by destroying the world's largest multi-level marketing organization, the black market in drugs, we would eliminate the jobs of the street corner vendors selling drugs to our children. Once again, quoting the district attorney of Harris County, Mr. Chuck Rosenthal, "When the only tool you have to work with is a hammer, everything begins to look like a nail," end quote. Is that how we are to view our fellow man if he makes a nebulous choice as to his intoxicant, as a nail to be hammered into submission? A quick program note. Next week's guest will be Steve Rolls of the UK organization Transform and Canadians Alison Murden and Philippe Lucas to discuss their use of the cannabis extract Sativex. Be strong, my friends. Be brave. Do it for the children. And as always, I remind you, because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful. To the Drug Truth Network listeners around the world, on behalf of engineer Philip Guffey, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage and the Unvarnished Truth. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Tap dancing on the edge of cannabis.